Jeremiah has, I think, we probably know him best as the weeping prophet. He's also been called the martyr prophet. He's been called God's iron pillar. And as I said, I think we've always had a fascination with him because of the great similarity between him and our Savior Jesus Christ. In fact, on one occasion, about 6 months before Jesus' crucifixion, he took his disciples off up in the regions of Caesarea Philippi. And for the first time in his own earthly ministry, he questioned his disciples specifically about himself. He asked, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And one of the responses that he got was, "Some think that you are Jeremiah." I can see how it would be easy for people to confuse the weeping prophet with the man of sorrows. They wept for the same reason. That was because of the sinfulness of their people. Also, neither man knew the joys of matrimony and a home. Both came quickly into conflict with the powers that be. Also, they each used the temple often as their center for teaching. And each was a lonely man who found the strength to carry on through an intimate communion with God. In fact, there are some who feel that Jeremiah's finest contribution to Christianity was not his public message, but his private life with God. You know, with the exception of the Psalms, by word count, Jeremiah is the longest book in the Bible. And in fact, we probably know more about Jeremiah than we do any other prophet, any other person in the Old Testament for that matter. And that's because of the self-disclosing nature of his writings. Jeremiah, we have in these 52 chapters more biographical detail about Jeremiah's life than is available for any other Old Testament character. That includes Abraham, Moses, and David. The book itself is really a mixture of literary forms. It includes prose and poetry. It includes taunts and laments. It also includes biography and history, and also active parable. Now, the parables that Jeremiah acted out are not so bizarre as those that you'll find in Ezekiel, but they were strange nonetheless. Among the props that he used in acting out these parables were a dirty girdle, a pottery jar, a cup of wine, and an ox yoke. On one occasion, to drive his point home, he offered wine to a group of teetotalers. He buried a stone between the pavement before a government building, and he purchased a plot of ground in the midst of the, in the height of the siege of Babylonian on the city of Jerusalem. His prophecies are not arranged in chronological order, and because there is such a large volume of material in Jeremiah's prophecies, and the fact that they are not in any sense arranged in chronological orders, in fact, you could really call this a narrative, really a biography, or a history. It's more of an anthology. It's a collection that has been put together. For example, I started to say that because there is so much material and it's not arranged in chronological order, sometimes this book has been called the most confused in the Old Testament. I happened to notice one of the Nicene fathers made the statement, who could possibly understand it? Because it's so jumbled up. For example, the first 20 chapters have prophecies that are made under the reign of Josiah, who was the first of the kings of Judah under which he lived. The very next chapter, chapter 21, has prophecies taken from the reign of Zedekiah, the last Judean king. But the fact is, there were three kings whose reigns intervened between Josiah and Zedekiah. Again, chapters 35 through 36 precede in time chapters 27 through 34. There are some authorities, including C.F. Kyle of Kyle Davis, who thinks that Jeremiah tried to arrange this topically. There are others, such as Merrill Unger, who thinks that it was because the book was written in several stages, as the book itself seems to indicate that it was not written in strict chronological order. The first 23 years of Jeremiah's prophetic ministry was done orally. And at one point in his life, there were some circumstances that required that it be written. And so he dictated his prophecies, what he had been prophesying for over 20 years. He dictated them to his amanuensis, a fellow by the name of Baruch. And he wrote them down in a scroll and took them into King Jehoiakim. And subsequently, Jehoiakim destroyed them. Well, we're told in chapter 36 and verse 32 that subsequently they were rewritten with additions. Obviously, there were later prophecies that were dictated to very probably to Baruch at the close of his ministry, and this was gathered together in his last years in the country of Egypt. Chapter 52 is practically identical to 2 Kings, the 24th and the 25th chapters. And if it is adopted from the historical records, it could have been added as a conclusion to the book at the directions of Jeremiah. The first chapter gives us an account of the call of the prophet. Chapters 2 through 35 contain his prophecies relating to Jerusalem and Judah. Chapters 36 through 45 are made up of biographical accounts. Chapters 46 through 51, there are several brief prophecies concerning foreign nations. And then chapter 52, as I mentioned, is a historical appendage dealing with King Zedekiah. There is some divergence between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint text. The Septuagint is just about 1/8 shorter than the Masoretic text. And that's all I want to say about that. I have personally a little more confidence in the Masoretic text, at least as far as the book of Jeremiah is concerned. And if you have questions about that, you can ask them later. He was the son of a priest by the name of Hilkiah. Now, I think what I want to do, though, at this point, I want to give you just a brief introduction to the book of Lamentations. And then I think probably the best way to survey this, because there is so much biographical material in Jeremiah, the best way would be just to take a look, just to take a survey of his life, taking a look at the high points. And then we'll take a look at the visions and the prophecies that he made from time to time at the appropriate place. Now, Lamentations is a sequel, obviously, to the book of Jeremiah. And Lamentations is a series of dirges. A dirge is a funeral poem or a funeral song, and it's in the form of an acrostic. It was written sort of like a national funeral, portraying the capture and the destruction of Jerusalem. The book does not expressly say who the author was. There are some modern so-called higher critics today who do not believe that Jeremiah was the author of Lamentations. They believe that the form of the language within Lamentations is so different from what is found in Jeremiah that there had to be a different author. However, there is an old and a consistent tradition that Jeremiah is the author of Lamentations. In 2 Chronicles 35 and verse 25, we're told about Jeremiah writing Lamentations after the death of King Josiah. And these were lamentations that Judean singers used for years in remembering this good king. Also, in the title of the book, in the Septuagint, it acknowledges Jeremiah as the prophet. In the Septuagint, it is called the Lamentations of Jeremiah. Also, there is an introduction to chapter 1 in the Septuagint that says, "And it came to pass after Israel was taken captive, and Jerusalem made desolate, that Jeremiah sat weeping and lamented this lamentation over Jerusalem and said." It seems that the Ananiasene fathers consistently agree that Jeremiah was the author without question. I looked up a couple of them. Origen, who was born in the 2nd century, was a 3rd century historian. I also checked what Jerome had to say. And these two just sort of spoke matter-of-factly about Jeremiah being the author of Lamentations. Now, he wasn't. The author had to have been a contemporary of Jeremiah, and he had to have witnessed the same horrible destruction of Jerusalem by its Babylonian conquerors. In the Hebrew Scriptures, chapters 1, 2, and 4 are written in the form of an acrostic. Now, an acrostic is a poem that has 22 verses, and each verse begins with one letter of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet in order. Chapter 3, the first three verses begin with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph. The second three verses begin with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Beth, and so on throughout the remainder of the chapter. Now, chapter 5 has 22 verses, but it has no acrostic. Chapter 1 of Lamentations tells us about the ruin of Jerusalem and the misery of the exiles because of their sins. Chapter 2 tells us about the fact that God, the ancient defender of Israel, has really given up on his people, giving them over to their awful fate. Chapter 3 begins with Jeremiah's grieving over the suffering of the people and really sort of accusing God for their suffering. But the chapter ends with his trust in God and with a message, or at least an attitude of hope. Chapter 4 talks about the former glory of Israel contrasted with their present misery. And then chapter 5 is a prayer for mercy. As I said, Jeremiah was the son of a priest by the name of Hilkiah, and he was born in the village of Anathoth. Anathoth lay probably about 3 miles northeast of the city of Jerusalem. And we're told in chapter 1 and verse 5 of the book Jeremiah that he was predestinated to be a prophet even before he was born. He began his ministry when he was about 20 years of age, and this was in the 13th year of the reign of Josiah. I've got an outline that you can kind of see just the high points, the greater milestones in his career. But this was, as I said, the 13th year of the reign of Josiah. And, you know, he was sort of like Moses when he received his call from God to become a prophet, in that he didn't feel like he was up to the task. According to chapter 1, verse 6, he's not just a child. But God reassured him that he would put the words that he needed to say in his mouth. As has been mentioned, Josiah really was the last good king of Judah. And we're told in 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 3 about this good man. He was godly from his youth. Now, where he learned this godliness, it certainly wasn't from his father, Amon, nor his grandfather, Manasseh. But he was godly from his youth, and in the eighth year of his reign, he began to seek after God. And then 4 years later, he began a purge to clean up Jerusalem of the idolatrous paraphernalia that his grandfather and his father had encouraged to be built. He began this reform throughout Jerusalem, throughout Judea, and really it reached up into the regions of what had been the northern kingdom of Israel. Well, in 627 B.C., this is when Jeremiah received his call. And he received a twofold commission in chapter 1 and verse 10. The Lord says, "See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down and to build and to plant." So he had a twofold commission. First of all, he was to root up and pull down and destroy and overthrow. And the thing that he was to root up and destroy is the same thing that remains the bane of our society today, and that is sin. Now, the particular sin about which the Lord was concerned was the fact that Judah had sunk to abysmal depths of idolatry. And all of the sins that are attendant, immorality, deceitfulness, dishonesty, brutality, and so on. It was really just horrible, the depths to which they had sunk. That was the thing that he wanted tore down and destroyed. He wanted Jeremiah to use his word as a hammer to bash this horrible thing to pieces. And then after the ground was cleared of the clutter, then he wanted him to build and to plant. Now he had two visions that confirmed this commission. And although his visions were not as spectacular as the visions that Jeremiah had at his calling in Isaiah the 6th chapter, they are really, there's no doubt about them nonetheless. The first was he saw an almond tree, an almond tree, you Californians. But he looked out and he saw an almond shoot. And the almond tree was the first to wake up in the spring. It was a wakeful tree. So using a play on words, God was declaring that he was watching over Jeremiah to perform it. He was watching over his word to perform it. And that Jeremiah could speak the divine word with the assurance that God is alert, that he is awake, and that his word would not fail. Then the second vision that he had was that of a boiling cauldron, or a boiling pot, and the contents were being poured out of this boiling cauldron from the north. That was symbolic of the fact that God was going to employ a kingdom from the north, and he was going to use that kingdom to conquer Judah and to pronounce his judgment upon the Jews because of their unfaithfulness. Now, as has been pointed out, and if you put that map up there for just a minute, there were three countries, three kingdoms that were dominant in the world at that time. Assyria had been dominant for about 300 years prior to this time. In fact, it was 100 years before, just 100 years before this time, that Assyria had destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel. But now, really, the power of Assyria had begun to crumble at this time, and there were two countries, two kingdoms. It was the Babylonian kingdom and the resurgent Egyptians that were going to vie for dominance in that region. And I think you can see the little country of Judah was going to get caught in the crossfire. It was really going to be the battleground. And the fact is, the kingdom from the north, which was to be Babylon, was going to emerge supreme. And this was going to be the instrument that God was going to use to bring judgment upon Jerusalem and Judah because of their unfaithfulness to him. In 621, you can put that out and come back up there now. I think this was really the first milestone in the life of Jeremiah, in that the priest Hilkiah, and very probably this was his own father, found a copy of the book of the law buried under some debris in the temple. This was a wonderful find. And those of you who are bibliophiles, you know what it's like to find a rare book, one you've been searching for a long time. But this was a wonderful find. They looked this over and they could see that the threats and the curses that were found therein were still valid against idolatry and unfaithfulness and so on. So this really just encouraged King Josiah to intensify his efforts to reform that region and to wipe out all the trappings and all the paraphernalia of idolatry. Well, at this time, I think that Jeremiah was really sort of on the sideline. There's not much said. He didn't say much during the reign of this good king. I do think, though, that he was very probably active in this campaign to cleanse the land of idolatry, because much of the sermon material in chapters 2 through 7 grew out of the context of this great reformation. Well, it was in 612 that Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, falls to Babylon. This was significant. This just reconfirmed in Jeremiah's mind that it was the kingdom from the north, the Babylonians, that were going to emerge supreme, and that they, in fact, were going to fulfill the prophecy, the vision that God had given him. In 609, we're told about an Egyptian army led by the Egyptian Pharaoh. If you'll put that map back up there just one more time. I think Megiddo was located on that map. Megiddo was about 11 miles from where Nazareth was, kind of northwest of the city of Jerusalem. But the Pharaoh of Egypt was leading his forces. The Pharaoh was a fellow by the name of Necho. He was leading his forces up toward Assyria to bolster the crumbling forces of the Assyrian soldiers in their conflict with the Babylonian forces. Well, Josiah heard about this, and so he gathered up his armies, and he went over to Megiddo, and he cut him off. Now, Necho didn't have a quarrel with Josiah at all. But nevertheless, Josiah went over there and cut him off at Megiddo, and the armies of Necho killed him. Well, this was devastating to Jeremiah. He couldn't understand the senseless death of this good man. And so he wrote, as we stated, according to 2 Chronicles 35 and verse 25, several lamentations, and the Judean singers used these for years to commemorate the death of this good king. Well, the people selected a son of Josiah to replace him, and they gave him the throne name of Jehoahaz. He only reigned for about 3 months, though, because Necho, en route back from Assyria, He called him to Riblah and put him in chains and sent him to Egypt in captivity. Well, subsequently, he selected another son of Josiah and gave him the throne name of Jehoiakim and to put him on the throne. Well, the people seemed to think that really Jehoahaz was the king, and they anticipated maybe his return back to Egypt. But Jeremiah prophesied that You should weep for him because he was going to die in the place that he had been taken captive, and he would never return. Well, Jehoiakim, having been placed on the throne by a foreign conqueror, was nothing more than just a puppet of the Egyptian Pharaoh, and consequently his first act in office was to impose a heavy tax upon the people in order to raise tribute for Necho of Egypt. You can put that outline back up there now, I think I'm through with the map. But, you know, in almost every respect, Jehoiakim was different from his father, Josiah. If Josiah was trying to pattern his reign after King David, Jehoiakim wanted to be another Solomon. In fact, Jeremiah draws a sharp contrast between the two men in chapter 22, verses 13 through 15. He was your typical Oriental tyrant. He was cruel, selfish, and indulgent. Like Solomon, he subjected his people to forced labor to build his magnificent palaces. He felt like he was entitled to live a luxurious lifestyle. He oppressed the people. He shed much innocent blood. And anybody who opposed him was courting death because he wasn't afraid of any man nor God. In fact, as far as I've been able to determine, he was the only Judean king that had the nerve who dared to put to death the prophet of God. And this is mentioned in chapter 26, verses 20 through 23. Well, in addition to just being a tyrant, he also revived the paganism of his father and his grandfather. It seemed like the people tired of the reforms of Josiah, and they enthusiastically returned back to the old ways. In fact, in chapter 7 and verse 18, Jeremiah says that every member of a man's family had a part in making cakes for Ishtar, the queen of heaven, the mother goddess who was worshipped by both the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Child sacrifice began to be practiced again in the Valley of Hinnom. There were idols that were set up in the temple. Social abominations were committed in the very shadow of the temple. They were plunged into gross immoral behavior. In fact, Jeremiah says that the men coveted their neighbor's wives. They ran through the streets like wild animals, trying to find as many partners as they could find to satisfy their lustful desires. Nobody could be believed. Nobody could be trusted. It was a horrible situation. And yet, they seemed to think that they could get away with this as long as they went into the temple from time to time and went through the formalities of worship. Well, at first, Jeremiah pleaded with the new king, and he urged him to follow the pattern of his good father, Josiah. In chapter 22 and verse 3, he says, "Thus saith the Lord, execute ye judgment and righteousness, and deliver the spoil out of the hand of the oppressor, and do no wrong, do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow, neither shed innocent blood in this place." Well, it became pretty obvious and very quickly that Jehoiakim wasn't interested in any of that. He was interested only in himself, and so as a result, Jeremiah unleashed the full force of his righteous indignation upon him. In Jeremiah 22, verses 13 and 14, he pronounced a woe upon a man who would build his house by unrighteousness and his rooms by wrong. A man who would use his neighbor's service and then not pay him wages. Somebody that would build a big house and large rooms and decorate it lavishly and do it solely for himself and pay no one to do it. And then in chapter 22, verses 18 and 19, he even told him he's going to die. And not only was he going to die, but he was nobody was going to mourn. Nobody was going to be sorry. There weren't going to be any lamentations saying of his death. And not only that, he was going to receive the burial of just a very unceremonial burial. Notice what he says. He says, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord concerning Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, they shall not lament for him, saying, Ah, my brother, or Ah, my sister. They shall not lament for him, saying, Ah, Lord, or all his glory. He shall be buried with the burial of an ass, drawn and cast forth beyond the gates of Jerusalem." In other words, he said, when you die, they're just going to drag you out of the gates of the city like a despised animal and throw you in the garbage dump. Well, he also preached his famous temple sermon at this point, recorded in chapter 7 and 26. And it was in the great temple sermon that he pleaded with the people to amend their ways and their doings. He told them that if they thought that they could engage in full-scale idolatry, that if they could engage in every kind of lasciviousness and immoral behavior, unrighteous behavior imaginable, and still yet think that because they go into the temple and go through a ritual of worship that they're safe, they couldn't be any more badly mistaken. He told them that the temple was not, it was no guarantee that God was with them, was going to see to it that no harm was going to come to them. The temple was not necessarily some bulwark of safety. In fact, he said, the temple itself is going to be destroyed. And you are going to be taken into exile just like those in the northern kingdom. Well, as you would imagine, his sermon caused quite an uproar. They were going to kill him. Well, they'd had about enough of that. And it was only, and it was at this time, that there was an elder. I'm not exactly sure who this elder was. These elders were. But they interceded on his behalf, and they reminded the people. Now, Micah made essentially the same prophecy. And Micah was spared. And so Micah, who I think was revered, was respected, because he was spared, then they allowed Jeremiah to be spared as well. But he further anchored them, though, by acting out a parable. He went to the gate, very probably the gate to the Topheth, the gate to the Valley of Kinnereth. He had a pottery flask, and he broke it in view of everybody. And then he said in Jeremiah 19 and verse 11, thus saith the Lord of hosts, even so will I break this people and this city as one breaketh a potter's vessel that cannot be made whole again. And they shall bury him in Topheth, and there till there be no place. And they shall bury them in Topheth till there be no place to bury. Subsequently, he went back into the temple court, and this was the first time that he was that he suffered physically for his prophecies. Pashur, the priest, had him beaten and had him placed in stocks for the night. And then when he was released, he was told not to ever come back to the temple again. Well, in 605, there was something very significant that happened again. This time, the Egyptian forces, under the leadership of the Pharaoh, Necho, they were routed severely in a battle at Carchemish by the Babylonians under the leadership of King Nebuchadnezzar. Well, just to show you how wily King Jehoiakim was, he had been paying tribute money to Egypt and to Necho. But when the Babylonian armies, under the direction of Nebuchadnezzar, destroyed them at Carchemish, he immediately began to send tribute money to Nebuchadnezzar and to Babylon. But in his own mind, really, he thought all this was temporary. He was just biding his time until he hoped that maybe they could declare Judah an independent state and revive the spirit of nationalism in Judah. But this significant event, though, was something that confirmed in Jeremiah's mind that, again, his vision was true. He could see that Jerusalem was doomed to complete destruction. And he talks about it in chapter 16 and 17, in chapter 4 as well, verses 23 through 26. He gives a vivid description of the day of destruction. And I'll tell you, if you want to read something that'll make the hair stand up on the back of your neck, you read his description of the destruction that Jerusalem was going to suffer. Really, he talks about it as though it had cosmic proportions. He describes the aftermath of this siege as though it was the aftermath of somebody dropping a nuclear bomb upon some place. It was going to be left sort of without form and void, just as the world, or just as everything was before the creation. The devastation that was caused by the great flood in the days of Noah, it was going to be comparable even to that. This horrible, horrible siege that was going to come at the hands of Babylon. Well, because of this, he felt like this was a wonderful time, a crucial time for his prophetic influence to be felt in the temple again. But he had been banned from going into the temple, so he was in a difficult situation. So what he did, all this prophecy that he had been doing for 20, 23 years, he dictated to his amanuensis, a fellow by the name of Barak. Barak wrote it down, and he took it in to King Jehoiakim. Well, Jehoiakim had it read to him, And when he read that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed, that Judah was going to be destroyed, that the people were going to be carried off into Babylonian exile, on the heels of this tremendous victory by Babylon up at Carchemish, that didn't sit well. That was a little unnerving to him. And then to be told that he was going to die a horrible death, and that nobody was going to be sorry. Nobody was going to cry or mourn or write lamentations about him. In fact, he was going to be drug out the gate of the city and thrown in the garbage dump. He was enraged. And he took his penknife and he cut the scroll to pieces and he burned it. We're told in chapter 36, though, that chapter 36 and verse 32, that was rewritten with additions. Well, in about 604, this is when Nebuchadnezzar had raided through Syria, Judah, and the Philistine cities, went all the way to the Egyptian border, and he got into a conflict with Egypt at that point, and both Egypt and Babylon suffered heavy casualties at that time. And so really Nebuchadnezzar, because he suffered so many casualties, he felt like it was necessary for him to take his crippled armies and to go back to Babylon. This is just what Jehoiakim had been waiting for. The Egyptians were weakened, the Babylonians were weakened, and so in a reckless attempt to grab independence, he refused to send his tribute money to Babylon. So that was just an invitation for Nebuchadnezzar to come back over and strike again. And that's exactly what he did. As a result, en route to Jerusalem, King Jehoiakim died. His son was placed upon the throne, Jehoiakim. He's also referred to as Jeconiah, also called Kaniah, Jeconias. I think he's mentioned in the Lord's genealogy in Matthew, the first chapter, as Jeconiah. But he ruled only for 3 months. And because after the Babylonian armies got there, after a 2-month siege, he was taken captive. His queen mother was taken captive. Others were taken, including the prophet Ezekiel. They were taken into Babylonian captivity. And they put in his place and gave the throne name to Zedekiah and put him on the throne. Now, this was still yet a third son of King Josiah, a brother to King Jehoiakim. He was a really quite a contrast to his brother. He was where Jehoiakim was a tyrant. This fellow was pretty mild-mannered. He was benevolent. But he was weak, and he was a vacillating ruler. He was easily swayed by the advice of those who were around him. And there were those, the pro-Egyptian influence groups and special interest groups, if you will, that were constantly pleading with him to make a break with Babylon and to make an alliance with Egypt. Well, at the same time, Jeremiah was constantly telling him, no, we don't want to do that. We have got to submit to Babylon, or we're going to be destroyed by them. The only way we can keep from being destroyed by Babylon is by submitting to them. And it was at this time that he acted out another one of his famous parables. He made a yoke of wood, just like an ox yoke. He put it over his neck, and he went into the temple court. And of course, the symbol was that they were to submit to the yoke of Babylon in order to keep from being destroyed. Well, there he was confronted by a false prophet by the name of Hananiah. This is the one about whom we've heard so much and read through the years, who prophesied smooth things and healed the hurt of the people only ever so much slightly. But he took exception to what Jeremiah said, and he said that, it's not going to be a long bondage over there. They are not going to destroy us. In fact, at most, people are going to be in Babylon 2 years. And at the end of that 2 years, they're all going to be brought back, including King Jehoiakim. The temple treasures are going to be brought back. Everything's going to be beautiful. Everything's going to be lovely. Well, of course, Jeremiah said, you don't sound like a prophet to me. God has always used his prophets to warn the people of God's judgments upon them when they've been unfaithful. You don't sound like a prophet to me. Well, that enraged Hananiah, so he took the yoke off of Jeremiah's neck and broke it over his knee. And said, that's how easily we'll break the yoke of the Babylonians. Well, not to be denied, Jeremiah went out and made a yoke of iron and stuck it over his neck. And he said, try to break this. And he told him, he said, the God is placing a yoke of iron over us with the Babylonians. And we're not going to be able to break the yoke of the Babylonians. And he told Hananiah, he said, you're going to die pretty soon, and he did. And I think it was probably from that that they delayed making their break with Babylon. But you know, the king, as I said, he was weak, and he just couldn't resist eventually the pressure to seek an alliance with Egypt. And he broke with Babylon, he made an alliance with Egypt, and of course that led to that political maneuvering led to the Babylonian return and the destruction of Jerusalem in the years 586 B.C. The siege was no doubt a horrible thing, as the Book of Lamentations seems to, it definitely implies, very graphically implies. It seems as though in Lamentations, Jeremiah is saying that in the aftermath, he looked over the destruction and the desolation, and said there was devastation as far as the eye could see, to the right, as far as the eye could see, to the left. There were little children wandering around in the streets helplessly, looking for something to eat. There were old people who were fainting because of starvation. Blood ran in the streets like water. The dead were stacked up like cordwood. It was nothing uncommon for the Babylonians to snatch an infant child out of the hands of a mother and throw it head down on the pavement and dash its brains out. They were brutal. They were a cruel, bloodthirsty, and merciless. But you know, in the height of all of this, it seems like Jeremiah never forgot that he had a two-fold commission. The first part of the commission was he was to tear down, he was to uproot, he was to destroy, and all this was about done. But in the aftermath, he was to build, and he was to plant. And he did something on that occasion to symbolize his belief in that, that it really must have seemed like sheer madness to those who were around him. He had been put in prison. Now Zedekiah put him in prison because his constant pleading for them to submit to the Babylonian yoke, Zedekiah felt like was demoralizing the people. And so he put him in prison. But while he was in prison, as I stated a moment ago, the siege began, and the walls were being knocked down. The Bible says that death was coming in the windows. People were so hungry, they resorted, according to the Book of Lamentations, they resorted to cannibalism, according to Lamentations 4 and verse 10. It seemed like the end was pretty near. I mean, in just a matter of hours, doom was going to be complete. And this was no time to be thinking about the future. And yet, at that time, Jeremiah got word that one of his close relatives over in Anathoth died. And as next of kin, he had the right to buy his property. And he bought his property, went through the procedures to buy that property, as though this was a sign that, you know, as bad as this was, after this is all over, there were going to be some people survive. There's hope on the other side of the siege. And then I think, really, the vision that has made the most indelible imprint upon the entirety of the world, as far as Jeremiah's writings are concerned, he gave the vision of the new covenant. In chapter 31, verses 31 through 35, he said, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith the Lord. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with thee in the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts, and write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord. For they shall all know him, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sins no more. You know, as far as I know, this is the first time that the expression new covenant was ever mentioned. Later, Jesus used that expression when he instituted the Lord's Supper. He took the cup and he said, this cup is the new testament or the new covenant in my blood. The writer of Hebrews in chapter 8 quotes this verbatim in showing that the old covenant had been done away and that now, by virtue of Jesus Christ, we have a new covenant. a New Testament. And I think that is significant that the entirety of the writings in the age of Christianity are called the New Covenant or the New Testament. This most assuredly had some immediate meaning for those people. There was to be hope among those who were going to survive this siege. In fact, Jeremiah wrote a letter to those in Babylonian exile and told them that it was from that remnant that this prophecy would be fulfilled ultimately. And then, of course, the ultimate fulfillment came with the Lord Jesus Christ and in his day when he was sacrificed in our behalf and made the new covenant operative or effective. Well, after the siege was over, Zedekiah, the king, was taken captive. He was taken, I think, first to Riblah. And there he received, I guess, probably the ultimate torture. He was made to watch as his sons were executed. And then he was blinded. So that he would remember for the rest of his life that the last thing that he saw were his sons put to death. And then he was taken into Babylonian exile. You know, they had treated Jeremiah, though, favorably. They told him that he could go to Babylon, he could have a nice place in Babylon to live, a comfortable quarters, a nice position, or he could remain there. And he chose to remain with those who were left behind in Judah. They put in Zedekiah's place a governor to look over the country, a governor by the name of Jedaliah. And you know, I think really that this time that Jeremiah spent with Jedaliah was probably the happiest time of his life. He and Jedaliah were on the same page when it came to reforming Judah. Now, the idolatry and all of the things that attended with that, all of the appendages, that had been destroyed. It had been taken away. The ground had been cleared. And now he was thrilled at the prospect of planting and building. And Jedaliah apparently was going right along with that. But, unfortunately, he was assassinated, and people were afraid that there would be reprisals from Babylonia. And so, out of fear, they grabbed Jeremiah and Barak, his amanuensis, and they fled to Egypt, where very probably they died.